from meager beginnings as an adolescent ambulance washer in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, to a decade-long legacy of bringing you breaking news before it makes the news. Broadcasting live from the studios of Scared Monkeys Radio Network via C-band satellite W3-957, Access Communications Channel 7, and worldwide via digital streaming audio at scaredmonkeysradio.com, it's the Dana Pretzer Show. And now, your host, Dana Pretzer.
Okay, good evening, everyone. Welcome to the program. We're going to start out tonight with the authors of a new book, Murder at the Supreme Court, Lethal Crimes and Landmark Cases. I'll hold it up for the TV camera so you can see it. If you click on the link in the show notes, you'll find out how you can buy it. The authors, Martin Clancy and Tim O'Brien, are both veterans of ABC News. Clancy is a producer and writer, and O'Brien as the network's longtime law correspondent. Good evening, gentlemen.
Good evening.
Welcome to the program. Nice to have you.
Thank you.
Now, just looking at the, I have the book, I've read the book, it's a fantastic book, and we'll get into the aspects of it here shortly. But looking at the show notes that I have that your publisher sent me, it talks about 1969 and the Supreme Court. And I'll start with whoever wants to answer that first. What specific is important about that date in the Supreme Court in the United States?
Martin? I'm not. The date doesn't ring my bell. Help me out here, guys.
Well, in 1969, the Supreme Court justices cast votes in secret.
Ah, okay. That's fine. The year just didn't click for me.
That's okay.
That was a rare incident in which the death penalty could have been declared unconstitutional by the Supreme Court. In fact, on an initial vote, they would have called unconstitutional the Alabama death penalty statute, which was similar to many other death penalty statutes in the South. A vote against that, if they had held that law to be unconstitutional, the ripple effect around the country might have ended the death penalty. As it happened, that vote unraveled. The fifth
it was, however, an early sign of a crack in the Supreme Court and the great discontent that became manifest in later years, that the court really was quite divided as to whether the death penalty should apply at all.
Yeah, I did a show last year. I think we were talking about Charles Manson and the Manson family, and the death penalty, of course, was brought up at that time. And that's one of the famous cases where, with the conviction, the death penalty, and it being overturned in California. Yet today we are seeing, and I'm not sure how much you guys are following this case, Jodi Arias is being covered by all the cable news channels, a murder case in Arizona. And I'll ask you, Tim, what the pundits are saying is that this is all being shown to try and save her life. Let's compare the late 60s, early 70s to today and the death penalty.
Well, one of the things you find in so many of these cases is that the crimes are truly horrendous. And it's instinctual to cry out for justice. But what is justice? Defining it is another matter. We're now finding that support for capital punishment is still strong, but not as strong as it was, particularly among juries, because we have, in the United States, we have now around 15,000 homicides a year. Very few of them bring death sentences. We still have 3,100 people on death row in the United States, but over the last several years, executions are only in the mid-40s, 40 to 50 executions. So it's not happening as frequently as it used to. One of the reasons we think is that juries under our Constitution, Supreme Court has held, must be told if you can render a lesser sentence, such as life without parole, juries have to be told that, and they're opting for that.
You know, it's interesting, and I'll ask this question to Martin, with the appellate process and the automatic appeals in death penalty cases and sometimes years before the death penalty is actually handed out. What about that, and what about the minds of the juries, and how do you cover that in the book?
Well, the problem for many with the death penalty is that it's not very efficient. That indeed, for example, if a family of a victim is looking for closure, they better have longevity on their side, because it's going to take years The state of Ohio just executed its 50th person in the 14 years they've had the death penalty back. That crime was committed in 1995.
Right.
The issue, the whole notion of closure, it seems to me, is cruel. That's my view of it anyway.
You know, Tim O'Brien, when you look at cases that you cover in the book and you talk about some of them, and you break it down as far as what justices consider and juries consider and what you look at, one thing that isn't talked about a lot is the young people, the youths that are incarcerated and may be eligible for the death penalty tried as an adult. Let's talk about young people and the death penalty.
Yeah, the Supreme Court has had some busy times with that. A few years ago, they threw out the death penalty for juvenile offenders. And only recently, in the last couple of years, following up on that decision, they threw out life without parole for juvenile offenders. They must at least be eligible for parole. They may not get it. But a juvenile offender who kills cannot be sentenced to life without any possibility of parole. I think it's a recognition that juveniles are, in fact, different. It's something every parent knows. But these cases, whether it's life without parole or the death penalty, still have divided the Supreme Court 5-4. And I think it's illustrative of the difficulty our Supreme Court has had with so many of these issues. We think of how difficult it is to decide whether to have the death penalty or not. Once you've decided to have it, as the United States has, how you implement it becomes even more difficult. You have some people saying, I think credibly, that even though someone's only 17 years old, their crimes are just as horrible and they can be just as cold-blooded as somebody who's 30 years old. On the other hand, you may have somebody who's 25 who might think like a child.
Yeah.
Is this a question for the Supreme Court to decide, or should these issues be left to judges and juries? That's a large part of the debate here.
Absolutely. Martin Clancy and Tim O'Brien are here talking about their new book, Murder at the Supreme Court. Martin, today's society and some of the high-profile cases that we see in the news, the mass shootings, for example, and the discussion of not guilty by reason of insanity, how does the book cover the death penalty and mental incapacity?
Well, the court has charted a very difficult course. On that, it took them a while and several cases, for example, to decide that you could not sentence to death somebody who was mentally retarded. The question of mental competence or insanity at trial is a different issue. That has not seemed to trouble the court as much as the issue of mental retardation.
Tim, law enforcement. Many, many years, and as you both know, I'm in Canada, but the show goes worldwide. I've always personally had a... I'm okay with the death penalty if you kill policemen, policewoman, or someone that's out there trying to protect life and property. And I interviewed Mark Lunsford just after his little girl, Jessica, was found murdered. And, you know, my mind was changed when you talked about the John Cooeys of the world. What about the press? What about the media? You're both media guys. And the influence that you have when it comes to these sorts of cases, public opinion and jury opinion?
I think that's extremely important. And unfortunately, lost in the media coverage, I think, over time, is the impact of these horrible murders on the loved ones left behind. It's certainly not lost in our book. You look at these crimes. In your case, you talk about the murder of a police officer. What about the murder of a child? What about mass murder? And all of the crimes in this book involve people who are truly bad, who've murdered people who are truly innocent, had nothing, just in the wrong place at the wrong time. As we were writing this, we noticed this book is taking on a sort of a pro-death penalty tilt,
right,
which we really didn't want because there are some problems with it. You know, you might agree that somebody deserves the death sentence. One of the problems we have in the United States with capital punishment, however, is the way it shakes down. It's so irrational. So you can never figure out who will get it.
Right.
With 15,000 homicides a year and only 40 executions. I mean, it's kind of a crapshoot.
Yep.
In one of the big cases, Robert Bork, a great judge, a highly regarded conservative, argued, people say it's irrational. Well, it is irrational only in the sense that some people who deserve the death sentence don't get it.
Yep.
He said, that's not a reason for throwing it out. But maybe it is. If it's that irrational, it's kind of like saying, pick a card. If you pick the wrong card, you'll be executed.
Yeah.
We certainly wouldn't allow a system of justice that worked like that, but in effect, that's kind of what we have. And I think the media needs to call attention to that.
Absolutely. Martin Clancy and Tim O'Brien are here talking about their new book, Murder at the Supreme Court. Click on the link in the show notes to find out how you can get that. Martin, when you look at, and I ask all my authors that come on the program this question, when you pick up the book in the bookstore, you look at it online, or you're listening to my show or another show that you people are on, and you want someone to go through that book, read it, understand it, and appreciate it, what is it about the book that will have someone not want to put it down?
I think it's the stories. Tim and I are essentially, I mean, reporters, as you know, are essentially storytellers, whatever they want to call themselves. And what we found was that behind all the legalese in important Supreme Court decisions were fascinating people, fascinating in the good sense and the bad. The victims, the perpetrators, the witnesses, the judges, some of the prosecutors. I mean, as you get, and we went back and reported many of these cases that we hadn't reported originally. We went back in time. And for storytellers, it was just great red meat. And that, I think, is what's going to stick with the viewer. I say viewer because I'm a TV producer at heart.
Sure.
But the reader is the stories and the people.
You know, Dana, these are all very important cases, and that's how we selected them. In fact, the Supreme Court selected them for us. They all set very important precedents. But as Martin is saying, behind every one of them are fascinating stories. Covering the Supreme Court for over 20 years, I found that true with many Supreme Court cases. I would tell my editors, you want me to do a story about what the Supreme Court said, what the law is, and the significance of this? Well, I can do that, but I actually have another story for you. The human drama behind this case. I need time for two stories. It's, all right, take another 5 seconds. But it's very tough. It's very tough
exactly.
to tell the human side, but we do that in the book. The stories within the stories, I think, are what make the book compelling.
And I was just going to say
In terms of what a reader can take away from it, I sort of hope that they have their predispositions kicked in the knees. I mean, I think this book tears apart, in a way, the knee-jerk responses to capital punishment. The people who are for it don't understand how screwed up the system is,
yeah.
And the people who are against it don't understand how savage some of the violence is and what the desire is for retribution on the other side. If this book gets people to think beyond those two preconceptions, if they start wondering, scratching their head, I will feel we've done a pretty good job.
Tim, as a longtime law correspondent, and you look at your career covering the Supreme Court, covering the high-profile cases, and you look at what you see today, and I use Arias as an example, Casey Anthony, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Take us back 20 years to today. How is the media doing when it comes to covering these sorts of high-profile cases?
Well, I think they do a reasonably decent job in covering them. We now have the networks are still major American television networks are still limited by the amount of time, 22 minutes for news. But we do have other outlets that are nonstop news, and sometimes these cases get more coverage than you really want. And I think I'm finding in many respects it's better than it's ever been. CNN and Fox News, at least during the day, I think they do a fine job in explaining the issues that these cases raise, better than we could do on the evening news in a minute and a half back when I started with ABC. I mean, I look back, and I had such incredibly important stories, and ABC would let me go on the road and do anything I want on any case. They never said no. It was amazing. I'd come back with enough material to do a documentary. But I'd get a minute and a half, and that was, in retrospect, kind of nuts. So when you have 5 or 6 minutes, as some television outlets have now, and the print media, you're getting a much better job.
Martin, last word to you. Longtime producer, writer, your book, Murder at the Supreme Court. Being able to tell that story to those that may not understand it, I like to call them Joe and Mary Sixpack, the public that are out there wondering, because maybe it doesn't affect me, but maybe someday I may be on that jury. How do you get the word across to them through the book that this is an important topic?
Oh, I think there's no question that the stakes are very clear in each of these stories. The stakes are life and death. And I think you get drawn in by the characters and drawn in by the situation. And I think Joe and Mary Sixpack can't, if they'll give us five pages, we've got them.
Exactly. Martin Clancy, Tim O'Brien, the book is Murder at the Supreme Court. You can pick it up, click on the link in the show notes. And listen, gentlemen, I appreciate it. I had a good good time with you.
Well, thank you for having us.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That's Martin Clancy and Tim O'Brien, both veterans of ABC News. I'll hold up the book again for you folks watching on television. And make sure and pick up the book. It's going to be a good one. We're going to take a break, and we'll be back here in just a few minutes with Gil Harrington. Her daughter Morgan was murdered, and we're trying to find out who's responsible. Right now, if you're listening live and you have an internet connection, go to findmorgan.com, and we're going to talk more about that in just a minute here on the Dana Pretzer Show. Okay, we're back. Looking at the website, findmorgan.com, and I want you all to go there, the beautiful, shiny, loving Morgan Dana Harrington was a true original. And we're going to put Jill Harrington on the line here in just a second. She brought much joy and fun to family and friends for 20 years. Her light and potential were extinguished when she was abducted from a Metallica concert in 2009 in Charlottesville, Virginia. Her body was found at Anchorage Farm in 2010. The person responsible remains at large, possibly still in the Charlottesville area. Jill Harrington, welcome back to the program.
Hi, how are you?
I'm not too bad.
I also want to tell you that Happily Dan is on the other line.
Oh, is he? Okay.
Came home unexpectedly early, so you've got both of us.
Oh, okay. Dan, hi. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Now, I'm telling the folks right now, listening live or listening to the replay of the program, go to findmorgan.com. That's findmorgan.com, and you'll be able to follow along with us here. Jill, let's start about the case. We've covered it on the program here, and we're going to continue covering it until you get the answers. Where is the investigation at now?
You know, we kind of have lost some steam. We believe that Morgan's killer is a serial murderer.
Right.
We can attach him forensically to two crimes, an abduction, rape in Fairfax 2005, and an abduction, rape, and homicide in 2009 of our daughter Morgan. I think there are more bodies out there. I think there's DNA in evidence files on the sidelines that hasn't been submitted by law enforcement because they don't know. I think there are women who have been assaulted by this man, and I want people to come forward now before the next body is found, and let's catch him before then.
Exactly. The Virginia State Police tip line, 434-352-3467. Dan, again, thanks for coming on the program. Let's talk a little bit about the investigation, where it went until the point you're at now. What is law enforcement telling you?
Well, we've from the time that Morgan's body was found and they determined that it was a homicide, probably the most significant piece of news that came from the police was that they had found a match between DNA found Morgan's case in Fairfax. Since that time, they continued to work the case on a daily basis, or tell us And significantly, though, I do think that the FBI has been involved in Morgan's case in the last 12 months or so, and on two occasions, similar to what they did with the East Coast rapist. They sort of blanketed the East Coast. I think there were 24 states with video boards with image or perpetrator on it. And they've done that twice, and we're told that that's going to happen again. I guess one of the things that's kind of interesting for us is that we sort of say, well, why is the FBI doing this? If this is just one person, Morgan case here. And so I think that really fuels, I think, Bill's and my thought. This is probably a bigger story than just Morgan's case and case.
You know,
I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Dan. No, I'm sorry.
Well, and I think a very significant event that occurred was in November of this year when the former lead investigator for Morgan's case, Joe Rader, who resigned from the Virginia State Police in January 2012, actually came out with a letter to the people who know about Morgan's case or know done this, and actually put the press in Virginia and was interviewed heavily in the Charlottesville area. Very unusual that a former investigator would come out with a letter. Police were happy.
Yeah. It's
He didn't really give any information.
It is strange. We're talking about Morgan Harrington. Go to findmorgan.com. Jill, the helpsavethenextgirl.com is another important website to go to, and you mentioned that at the start of the interview. Tell us about that.
Yes. How does one respond to the murder of a child? We refuse to let Morgan's life mean little. And one thing that we can do is try and protect other young women. So in 2012, we created a foundation, Help Save the Next Girl, which tries to empower and create community for young people on college campuses and younger to look out for one another, to be aware of personal safety issues, and to try and change the culture that allows predatory behavior against young women from within, from peers, not coming from on high, from adults, but from within the group.
Yeah, Dan, when you mention protecting our children, I think we can all agree there's nothing more important than that. What lessons, and I hate using that term closure, because for your family there never will be closure, so I use the term lessons or answers that we all hope and pray that you'll get to get this animal off the street that killed your daughter. But what can we tell the other folks that are out there, the young family that's taking their daughter to university for the first time, dropping them off, or their son? What can we tell them? What can we teach them to help protect the kids?
You know, one thing which we have found, particularly in our dealings with young people at Virginia Tech, University of Virginia, is that young people, ages probably 50, 25, see themselves as being covered with Teflon, that nothing bad. We've seen this over and over in Charlottesville, where we go to the bridge where more plus young women running with earbuds and really no regard at all with what possibly happened. And I think the thing is that one young people realize they need to watch out for one another. It's very easy for, just as in Morgan's case, for someone to get separated from a group, turn out all fine, and you need to realize, I think particularly young women more than men, need to to have someone with them when going out in public places, and particularly when they've been drinking or at a concert, some large of them. That's the message.
Well, exactly.
I mean, yeah. You know, that it's such a little thing, that buddy system. You know, we are trying to inspire, educate, and empower as many young women and girls and young men as we can to try and help them change the culture in which they're separate individuals. We want them to have insight into community and responsibility towards one another. That's what is needed.
We're talking to Dan and Jill Harrington, Morgan Harrington's folks, about her murder. And they are looking for answers. Who's responsible? Is it a serial killer? Do the predator that is out there on the loose needs to be caught? And this family deserves answers. Jill, I'm going to let you guys go here in a few minutes, and I do appreciate you coming on. 3 years, and I'm sitting watching the website now, and I'm looking at this beautiful young girl. And 3 years probably seems like 300 years, but then it probably seems like just yesterday when you got the bad news. What kind of advice can you give to families that are going through something like this right now as far as missing loved ones?
You know, the missing piece is the hardest time. I mean, it's because you fill in the blanks in a terrible way. Isn't it tragic to be happy that you have recovered the body of your daughter? But it's better than the missing piece.
Yeah.
Morgan was missing for 101 days, and we were twisting. That was an excruciating time. It's really a primitive, visceral thing to bring the body home and to memorialize the person. And we know many families that have not had that opportunity.
It's
having a body doesn't make you get over it.
Oh, God, no.
But it
no.
makes it easier for you to get past it.
Yeah. It's every parent's nightmare. Dan, I'll give you the final word.
I think the important thing for us to tell people is that there continues to be a murderer who is in probably the Central Virginia area. There's $150,000 reward for information leading to the arrest.
Yeah, you're starting to cut out on me, Dan. We're just losing your phone signal. Joe, if you could just repeat what Dan had just said. I just lost his phone signal.
Dan said that, you know, he wants to remind people that there's a $150,000 reward
right.
for information leading to an arrest in this case. And if that's not enough motivation, the morality and the call to do the right thing, step forward, move with your conscience, and let's get this predator off the street.
Absolutely. And any tips or information in the investigation of this case can be directed to the Virginia State Police tip line, 434-352-3467, and make sure to go to findmorgan.com. Folks, my heart is with you. You know that, and we'll continue to stay in touch and try and get you the answers you so deserve.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate
it. Take care. Bye-bye. Take care. 241.
Good night. And what do they mean by 241? Go to that webpage and you'll see. It is important. So helpsavethenextgirl.com, findmorgan.com, a case that we've talked about for years here now. I guess it's been 3 years. And, you know, you can't think of a more heartbreaking feeling for the family. Closure? No, you never get it. Answers? I sure hope someday. We're going to take a break. This is the Dana Pretzer Show, and we'll be back with our sister blogger, Blink, from Blink on Crime, to talk about Jody Arias and that trial. We'll be right back. It always seems like my computer goes nuts just when I'm about to have this next guest on. I don't know if it's a thing between her and it, but are computers its, Blink?
We're both magnified.
I don't know. It is. It's having a fit, and I apologize. It's running the same PSA over and over again. It tried to close the show, and it's, I don't know. I need to slap it around a little bit. It was watching, I was using it to watch Jody Arias today, and, you know, we'll get into that in a minute. But
so there was nothing Freudian or in the probiotic commercial that played before my appearance?
You know what? This is something else. Watching this
cleanse thoroughly.
Watching this girl testify is something else. But let's. Ooh. I want to put this on hold for a second and talk about Morgan Harrington for a minute. I don't know if you got to hear that, but
I did, and I appreciate that because I was actually going to ask you that. Yep. I just want to say how fond and humbled I am by Dan and Jill Harrington.
Yep.
I mean, in the face of this tragedy, and make no mistake, it is a horrific tragedy that was perpetrated by a serial monster, and they are not inflating or over-dramatizing the dangerousness of this individual. And the way they've been able to turn this into a really a hopeful strategy lesson for young women is nothing short of miraculous.
Yep.
And I'm not doing the explanation justice, probably. They're both lovely, kind, wonderful people that really do not, at the end of the day, want to see this ever happen, another young woman and another family. For them to be able to put that front and center in their grief, it's just miraculous.
Isn't it amazing, though, and I, you know, family after family after family that I've interviewed on the program are able to do that. They are able.
And if you notice that both Jill and Dan at the end said, listen, and this is an important point.
Yep.
You know, we were able to recover our daughter, and so many families do not.
Yeah.
And you and I have talked about this countless times when it comes to missing person cases. Morgan was missing for 101 days. They were able to bring her remains home. And that does make a difference in a family.
Sure it does. Yeah.
It does. I mean, Jill put it far more eloquently than I could, but it does make a difference. Some people don't even have that, at least, you know, to deal with your grief at some point, because the unknown could be worse.
Oh, absolutely.
And I applaud them. I just think they have been tireless in their effort to keep Morgan's case alive. I'm very fond of them. We've covered it extensively. We've broken tremendous strides in her case.
Yep.
And I'm frustrated where we are today.
Yep.
Dan brought up a good point that the FBI has been more involved. They have been. I encourage it. And I don't know where that's going to go, because I think this is one of those cases where we need to go back to the beginning.
Start
and
again.
Put fresh eyes on it.
Yep.
This is a solvable case.
What about the law enforcement resigns, writes this letter, and what about that?
I think that you're talking about Lieutenant Rader.
Yes.
I think that he meant well.
Yeah.
I don't think it, you know, when you're not in law enforcement anymore and you know, the case that got away,
yeah,
kind of situation, I do think that plagued him in that way. I personally don't think it was a good idea, and I'll tell you why. It does not lend itself to the fact that they have a control of this case. And in law enforcement, if you're not going to speak on it, when something does break, the last thing you want is for people to think you don't know what the hell's going on.
Exactly.
And that happened.
Yeah, exactly. Anywho, Blink from Blink on Crime is here, our sister blogger. And like I said, my computer is having a mental breakdown tonight because it and I watched Jody Arias testify today. And honestly, you know, I've been around for a long time, 30 years in law enforcement and doing this show for, well, about 17 years now, and I've heard a lot of people testify, and I've been there when they've testified, and so have you, but is she human?
Do you know, when I watch her, you know what I'm thinking?
Hmm.
I'm thinking, oh my Christ, if only Casey Anthony took the stand.
Exactly.
This would be less painful.
Yes, exactly. Wow.
I'm not trying to be glib.
No.
But I've heard, you know, we keep contrasting these two sociopaths because at the end of the day, listen, these two are, you know, by the book, textbook sociopaths. They just are. And you can, and once you, if you follow true crime, and I know that your listeners do, they're starting to understand the differences between, I think Dr. Bond was on your show one time, and he specifically addressed the psychopath or the sociopath, and he did a really good job. And I think you're seeing that. I mean, who does she think is buying it? The jury's questions have reinforced my faith in the system.
Yes. Yo, I agree. And watching her, as painful as it is, it's fascinating to see the response. It's fascinating to see her interaction with the prosecutor, the little bulldog that he is, jumping around out there. And we'll get into that in a minute or two. And the obvious coaching that she's had as far as how to respond, and she is something that we could sit and analyze for show after show after show after show after show. But to make, and I've asked you this question before, is this just simply a way to try? And we did the death penalty book guys tonight. Is this a way to try and save Jodi Arias' life, or are we just trying to drive us nuts for 18 days?
Well, from her attorney's perspective, that is his formulary goal is to save her life.
Sure.
This is a death penalty case. That's his absolute obligation. I can't think that Kirk Nurmi, her defense attorney, who literally requested to be removed from this case,
I know.
Was denied.
Yeah.
I literally think that he sees his goal as saving her life, and whatever else happens is a bonus. Now, second to that, as we've discussed in the past, I think that he is cognizant of the fact that, you know, mistrial will help him out and help get a possibility of a plea for man two, which the reality is, the way that the prosecutor came into this, this is a man two case. You can't prove, in my opinion, you can't prove some of the charges. You certainly can't prove felony murder. There's been no crime attached to this.
Right.
Premeditation is it becomes difficult when you're posing for photos nude after having sex with the defendant.
Yep.
Now, premeditation under the law could be second, but you still, as we've learned with, in particular, you know, OJ and the Casey Anthony trial, you cannot leave those gaps in the jurors' minds. You have to sew that up. You have to give them the picture to which they can put somebody to death. Because if they do find her guilty of capital murder, that's in their mind. They're knowing that what that decision is they could be putting her to death. They don't have the right, well, as they're charged, they don't have the right to say, okay, we already know that we're going to sentence her to life in prison. It doesn't work like that. These are two phases of the criminal prosecution that are to be addressed separately.
What about Arizona and the jury asking the questions? Some people are sitting back saying, what's with that?
Personally, I liked it.
I do too.
I really did. The only downside to that is, if you don't have, as a prosecutor, if you don't have a particularly strong case, you're going to know that when it's too late, if you've got a defendant that takes the stand. Now, if she hadn't taken the stand, you know, we're juxtaposing this against Anthony a little bit, it's absolutely brilliant for the defense, because they're going to learn where the holes are, and they're going to shear up their rebuttal case fairly tightly. In other words, you know, we're going to take the tips and the hints. And try and figure out how we can level the playing field. So from that perspective, if the talent or the assets on the prosecutor side of the defense are not on par, I could see how it would be a problem. But here's what I love about it. The jury owns their own participation. They're asking the questions
right
in front of the court, in front of the media, in front of the witness. In this case, also the defendant. And so I have to think that that's going to, you know, grease the slides, as you will, when you're going into deliberations. There's not a whole lot that they're going to have to kibitz over.
No.
Because the questions are answered.
Yeah, that's for sure. Blank from Blank on Crimes here. all these days, 18 days, whatever it's been.
Is it only 18 days?
I don't know what it's been, but it's unbelievable. You just keep flipping around and around. Anyway, and we haven't even got to rebuttal yet. How much longer are we going to have to put up with this, even though we are all fascinated?
I believe they started. They'll start rebuttal tomorrow.
Yeah.
The questions from the jury were over today, and I think Juan Martinez, I think he came back out swinging. I don't think he did his diligence respectfully up front.
No.
I think the fact that I've seen prosecutors time and again not take, you know, very seriously this CSI effect that we keep talking about in a high-profile case, and they had better do that. Because I do think he brought his A game at the end. And in case in point, one of the things that I was, in particular, I thought was noteworthy was when she testified to the 25 caliber weapon now being in a holster, now being on the top of a very high built-in closet. And my response to that was, okay, well, here's what should have been done. The prosecution should have built the model or went into that actual environment, taken a, whether a deputy or somebody like that, same size and stature as Arias, and reenacted her doing that. Because I can tell you right from looking at that shelf, it's on a what's called a dowel, wood dowels, because they're movable up and down.
Yep.
If she put her even slight 120 pounds with just the tip of her foot as described on the top, that thing is going right down to the bottom.
Yep.
That would break. And what the jury would need to see, and they haven't seen in this case, is a demonstration like that to show the idiocy of some of the things that she's trying to put forth as factual information that happened on June 4th. They're so far apart from this being a self-defense case.
Yeah. Blink from Blink on Crime is here. Yeah, I agree. The prosecutor, I thought, did a pretty good job today earlier on. He was putting his foot in his mouth a little bit, but now he's starting to tie things up in a not a neat bow, but he's starting to get there. You know, the bunny ears thing when you're learning to tie your shoes. But Jody Arias, you know, I guess this is a big old world that we live in, and there's lots of people out there that you can never expect that are out there. But here's a person who, I'm not sure what she's thinking on the stand, if she honestly thinks she's going to beat this or she's just going to try and survive and not die in the gas chamber or whatever.
She, in her mind, is a sociopath, Dana. She thinks this is believable.
And I was just about to say, or is she someone who's selling this because she actually believes it?
She believes it. She has convinced herself of these things. There is not a portion of her that's going to go to the text that Travis sent her, which really says it all on May 26th, and that was, you're a sociopath. You know, I'm paraphrasing. Yep. You're a sociopath, and you're the worst thing that ever happened to me. Why that young man did not make that the end, I guess we can speculate forever, but it should have been, because those realizations to a person like Jody, who clearly in her past, in her pathology, you're seeing the struggles of a sociopath. That was it for her. That was the one. You know, he was the brass ring for her, and she failed miserably. And in her mind, everybody's laughing at her now. Now she wasn't a good Mormon. Now she wasn't a good girl. Now she wasn't worthy. It was just everything into one. That being said, there's nothing that happened on June 4th. There's nothing that happens in this girl's background, in her psych profiles, anything that can explain to me, as a trained and educated profiler at this point, what the hell caused her to stab this man 27 times after shooting him in the face, in my opinion, and slitting his throat in a impossible approximated wound 6 inches long across his neck. None of that makes sense to me, and I want to understand it because I want to prevent it next time.
Yep. And you got to think about that picture of him in the shower and the look on his face, and think in your mind, what's he looking at outside that shower door?
I believe he was looking at her with holding a gun on him.
Damn right.
I believe he knew that his life was over.
Yep.
Or suspected that he had very little chance. I believe that what happened is he assessed that he needed to act, flung the shower door open, knocking the camera over.
Yep.
And unfortunately, she shot him at that time and slowed him down a bit. But very small caliber weapon, very, you know, anti-debilitating, if you will, for, you know,
yep.
for a facial wound. And what ensued, I think one thing I'm glad about is that this was a highly defensible case. Had Kirk Nurmi been a forensic guy or paid more attention to the autopsy protocol in this case, you would have seen a defensible case. I don't really talk. I'm not really going to talk about it until it's over, but I can see some things in the autopsy protocol that make more sense to me if there was a physical altercation between these two.
Yeah.
I do believe that happened. Now, I believe that happened because he was trying to save his life. I don't think he attacked her.
No.
But I do think that the scenario would promote one of more in line with her defense had he been versed and skilled or saw it. You know, if you go the way of Jose Baez and 12 different attorneys at different, you know, multi-disciplines, I think he could have got there. I'm thankful that he didn't, because this is, as you pointed out, this is utterly painful.
Ugh.
To watch.
Ugh.
She is moon bat.
Yeah. I don't know. It was so bad today, I switched over to Martha Stewart. No, anyway. It's something. The rebuttal case is coming on. Again, of course, we said it with Anthony that there's going to be a conviction, and it didn't happen, so I guess anything's possible. But I've asked you before. I'll ask you again. Your prediction, where is this going to go?
I believe strongly that there will not be an acquittal. I think there's a... Unfortunately, there's a level of possibility of a hung jury. I don't think the mistrial, I mean, as a result, it would be a mistrial, but I think that's possible. And I'll tell you why. Because this goes to a lottery. Nobody knows right now who's going to deliberate. And I have to see that, and personally, while I think it's a good idea, when you talk about a high-profile case, now you're talking about people that have invested this time and effort, and they're not going to love not being able to deliberate on this case. So I think in particular that's the drawback of having a lottery. So I'm concerned that in the beginning there might be some issues where they've got to seek counsel from the judge, you know, they may have to replace a juror, that kind of thing. But Judge Stevens has magnificent control of this, of her courtroom.
Yep.
She is clear that she is not going to see this under her watch going by the wayside. So I do think that there will be a verdict, and it's not going to go well for Ms. Arias.
No.
The only caveat I'm going to put in that is if there is some type of impropriety or some type of tampering or some type of hung jury issue. If it goes to verdict, it will be guilty, and it will, unfortunately, I believe, result in her not getting the death penalty. I don't think they'll give her death.
It'll be interesting to see. Blink from Blink on Crime. Always a pleasure, ma'am. Talk to you soon.
Back at you. Take care, Dana.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
That's Blink from BlinkOnCrime.com. And the very painful yet interesting Jodi Arias trial. We're going to take a break, and we'll be back with Gene Cervantes from Victims. He's a victims advocate. He's from Citizens Against Homicide. And we're going to learn a little bit more about the upcoming conference in Las Vegas. Bill Cosby will be the keynote speaker. And we're going to talk to Gene in just a minute. You are listening to The Dana Pretzer Show here on Scare Monkeys Radio. Hey, we're back. This is The Dana Pretzer Show. Gene Cervantes is a victims advocate, and he's part of the Citizens Against Homicide group that are putting on a conference in Las Vegas in April. Bill Cosby will be one of the keynote speakers, and one of the speakers is my good friend Cherry Simpson. And I wanted to talk to Gene. We had him on the show last time and thought I'd bring him on again to talk a little bit more about the conference. Welcome back, sir.
Well, thank you very much. My pleasure to be back, and I extend my sincerest thank you to you for allowing us to come back.
Oh, no, it's no problem. Tell us a little bit about Citizens Against Homicide.
Well, Citizens Against Homicide is the victim advocacy organization that was founded by Jane Alexander, often referred to as Citizen Jane, and Jan Miller. Jane, unfortunately, passed away in December of 2009, but we carry on her work and retain her philosophy on victim advocacy. We advocate on the part of victims, families of murder victims. We also look at cases where, for instance, a kidnap that there's every indication there was foul play and a death, a missing person where there's every indication of a death. So we look into that as best we can. We run interference for families who do not really understand criminal justice system, so we help navigate this, the process and the system for them, with them. We do a variety of other work, being ex-law enforcement, we have a better understanding of the process. So that helps also, and it garners a added respect from the law enforcement agencies and lead detectives that we contact on behalf of the families.
Now, we have a conference coming up in April in Las Vegas. Tell us about that.
Well, it's our first inaugural conference, and it will be held at the Monte Carlo Resort and Casino in Las Vegas April 12th and 13th. The 12th is primarily a meet-and-greet cocktail reception, an opportunity for people to mingle and make new acquaintances, as well as meet people we've been talking with for years on the telephone and never really have met personally face-to-face, so we put a face with a name and a voice. We'll also start the next day, Saturday, the 13th, with a registration and continental breakfast. It'll feature some, I believe there's three presentations in the morning, three in the afternoon, and then gourmet dinner, and Bill Cosby then will be closing the conference. The speakers, as you mentioned, one is Terry Simpson, a very dedicated advocate for victim rights.
Absolutely.
She'll be giving a presentation on domestic violence, along with Angie Gilliam, whose daughter was murdered in California, just outside of Lodi. And we'll have Bill Spriggs, a employee with the Sacramento County District Attorney's Office, Laboratory of Forensic Science. She's a DNA expert, and we'll be having Dr. Scott LaPointe, medical examiner and forensic pathologist from Pittsburgh, New York, one of the presenters had to big off, so we replaced him with Vito Colucci. Vito is a retired detective from Connecticut. He's been on the Nancy Grace show numerous times, Jane Les Mitchell. He's a regular on CrimeWire at Black Talk Radio. He's been on MSNBC with Catherine Cryer, Star Jones, Glenn Beck. He's been on all of those shows, Larry King, and before he retired. So he's got a lot of expertise and a lot to offer. And we are also going to have a very interesting panel. It's going to be a panel that consists of a chief deputy district attorney from Yolo County in California, a judge, as well as a victim, a the mother, I believe it's the mother, you got to bear with me because my daughter is the coordinator and she just has some notes for me. She's in school. Anyway, the death penalty of this case is going to be discussed, I believe, shortly or briefly, and there's going to be a panel, like I said, of experts who will give a very, very enlightening and interesting presentation on the death penalty, and there's going to be an opportunity for questions from the audience. So it's quite the conference. It's going to be extremely educational. We do have an added feature that we would like to extend a formal invitation to attend this conference to those organizations that are nonprofit and are victim service, victim rights oriented. They are being offered a free registration with the contingent, with the stipulation that they book a room at the Monte Carlo under the CAH, Citizens Against Homicide, conference name.
Okay.
So that's an added feature. It's quite a savings. We realize the economy is stifling for some organizations and some individuals, and so we thought we'd try to encourage them to come by giving them a free free registration.
Oh, that sounds good. And again, the conference April 12th and 13th at the Monte Carlo in Las
Correct.
Vegas. If you click on the link in the show notes or go to citizensagainsthomicide.org and click on the events tab, you'll be able to learn more. Gene, always a pleasure, and let me know if I can do anything more to help.
I certainly will, Dana, and appreciate your help so far.
No problem. Thank you, sir.
Okay.
Bye-bye. Bye. That's Gene Cervantes, and make sure and check out the conference. It's an important one. You can call the Monte Carlo, 888-529-4828, and we'll be having more about the conference as the weeks go on, and hopefully we'll be able to do a show with someone who is attending there. That's it. I hope you enjoyed tonight's show. My name's Dana Pretzer. Make sure and check out our webpage at scaredmonkeysradio.com. We'll see you again next time.
You've been listening to the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We invite you to discuss tonight's program with other listeners by joining us at scaredmonkeysradio.com, where you'll find program archives, links to tonight's guests' websites, and further information regarding tonight's topics. Scared Monkeys Radio is a production of scaredmonkeys.com. Thanks for listening.